content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. And we're reading this week from the September 4th, 2020 issue of the Week magazine. Quite a busy cover drawing this week. We've got a picture of President Trump. He's riding a wrecking ball, one of those that's hanging from a crane. He's at the bottom of his swing. He's holding onto the chain and smiling. He's already smashed the arm off the Statue of Liberty and torn through the top of the Capitol building. There's rubble all around him on the ground. There's little coronavirus balls and Twitter birds floating around in the air. And in the very foreground is one of those black slates that they use when they're introducing a movie where they click it. And it says, The Trump Show, Director Donald J. Trump, Take Two. The title, Four More Years, How Republicans Made Their Case for a Second Term of Trump's Disruptive Presidency. And that will be our first main story, but I'm going to start this week with the editor's letter. Historian Henry Adams once defined politics as the systematic organization of hatreds. It was true in the Civil War era and just as true today. In 2020, who you hate is who you are. Voters are largely driven by what they're against rather than what they're for. Political scientists call this phenomenon negative partisanship, and its dominance has been on full display at both the Democratic and Republican national conventions. At the Democrat soiree, a parade of speakers from former President Obama to several disaffected Republicans echoed the same message. Our nation cannot survive another 4 years of Donald Trump, who has shown he will tear our democracy down if that's what it takes to win. The Republicans this week countered with dire warnings that Democrats won't let you go to church and will empty the prisons and fire the police and invite MS-13 to live next door. It's a far cry from Ronald Reagan's shining city on a hill or Obama's hope and change, but as political scientist Rachel Bitkoffer observes, partisanship is a hell of a drug, especially when it's cut with a heavy dose of existential fear. It's hard to dispute the point. Both Democratic and Republican partisans, research has found, have come to despise the other tribe and their elected leaders more than they like their own leaders. Ticket splitting by voters has become rare, and in any given election, 90% of Democrats and Republicans vote for their party's nominee. Harnessing fear and hatred can drive turnout, which has become the key to winning national elections. But as America stumbles further down this road, we are headed toward profound danger. For democracies to function, voters and parties must be willing to accept defeat. Once the votes are counted, the losers must concede that their opponents have a legitimate, if temporary, claim on power. Will that happen this November? And if it doesn't, what then? That was from Editor-in-Chief of the Week, William Falk. And we will turn the page and take the first main story, the GOP's case for a second Trump term. What happened? The Republican Party nominated Donald Trump for a second term this week at a virtual convention whose opening message focused less on what Trump will accomplish if he's reelected than on the ravages America will suffer if he's not. On the first night, speaker after speaker casts Joe Biden as a tool of the radical left who will unleash what Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina called a fundamentally different America, a dystopian nightmare where freedoms are curtailed. Mobs invade the suburbs, and rioters and criminals run rampant. They'll disarm you, empty the prisons, lock you in your home, and invite MS-13 to live next door, said Representative Matt Gaetz of Florida. The second night struck a softer tone, featuring Trump pardoning a black bank robber and presiding over a naturalization ceremony for five immigrants of color. In a video segment, female aides lauded him as a champion for women. The convention broke from previous norms in a number of ways. The Republican Party declined to create a platform, instead saying it will continue to enthusiastically support the president's America First agenda. Prominent Republicans, including sitting governors, senators, and former President George W. Bush, steered clear of the event, which featured addresses by seven Trump family members. And additional boundaries between campaigning and governing were repeatedly crossed, with the White House regularly used as a setting. Trump was slated to appear all four nights, speaking Monday from the convention hall in Charlotte, North Carolina. He issued a warning about Democratic voter fraud. "They're using COVID to steal the election," he said. On the eve of the convention, more than two dozen former GOP members of Congress endorsed Joe Biden, including former Senators Jeff Flake of Arizona and John Warner of Virginia. Days earlier, more than 70 Republican former national security officials from the Reagan and both Bush administrations issued a letter calling out Trump's assault on our nation's values and institutions and pledging support for Biden. "It's time to reinstate the moral foundations of our democracy," they wrote. What the editorials said. "The Grand Old Party has become little more than a Trump booster club," said USA Today. "In his first term, Trump has systematically trashed most of the principles the party once held dear, including limited government, fiscal responsibility, and moral rectitude. Republicans who once embraced these tenets have spent the past 3.5 years sticking their heads in the sand. As their convention devolves into an extravaganza of adulation, they have only themselves to blame for allowing Trump to transform a once proud party into a cult." "The Republican Party deserves a platform," said the National Review. "Granted, party platforms are often intensively negotiated word salads read only by the party's enemies. Still, the Democrats produced a detailed 92-page manifesto making clear what they wish to do with power. The Trump campaign issued only a vague list of aspirations, such as teach American exceptionalism. Voters can only conclude that the platform is Trump himself." What the columnist said. "The convention's most jarring element is the sheer unbridled messianism that's been on display," said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. "One speaker after another has lauded Trump's courage, infinite benevolence, economic genius, and uniformly perfect handling of the pandemics that's killed 180,000 Americans and infected nearly 6 million. None of this bizarre overkill is likely to persuade independent voters, but perhaps the goal is merely to please the audience of one." "Don't fool yourselves, libs," said Matt Lewis in thedailybeast.com. "The convention has been stunningly effective. Smug liberals may see propaganda so blatant that everyone can see through the lies, but once again, they're forgetting not everyone sees things as they do. Yes, Trump is a dismal failure, but the masterful staging has worked to present him as a good and decent president and reminded wavering heartland voters that the enemy is the left, radical protesters, and the media. That will be enough to bring some of them back to Trump. Expect this race to tighten. In a tough re-election climate, there's a point of political light for Republicans," said Timothy Carney in WashingtonExaminer.com, the lawlessness and disorder in American cities. As peaceful protests against police brutality give way to naked looting and anarchist violence, Republicans see a way to lure back white suburban voters. The convention finally gave Trump the miracle he has predicted, said Stephen Collinson and Maeve Reston in CNN.com. The pandemic did just disappear. While in the real world, more than 1,000 Americans were still dying from COVID-19 every day, and unemployment remained above 10%, speakers glossed over the pandemic as a vanquished threat, if they mentioned it at all. In her speech, Melania Trump finally offered some sympathy for the dead and their families. Even then, the administration's culture of denial was in evidence. Few in the Rose Garden crowd wore masks or maintained safe social distance. Controversy of the week takes on the Democratic convention. Did Biden make his case? The kindness was the point, said Zach Bocamp in Vox.com. Last week's virtual Democratic convention, ingeniously redesigned for the COVID era, focused on the character and failures of President Trump, contrasted with the fundamental decency of the Democratic nominee, Joe Biden. When the White House is occupied by a cruel man whose indifference to ordinary Americans has killed tens of thousands in the pandemic, who has vengefully taken migrant toddlers away from their parents, and who has deliberately stoked racial and cultural animus and divided the country, the prospect of a president who might actually care about people and do what it takes to protect them offered an off-ramp. Speaker after speaker, most memorably a 13-year-old boy Biden befriended and counseled on overcoming his stutter, highlighted the nominee's deep reserves of empathy acquired over a lifetime of personal tragedy. Biden himself had to close the sale, said Frank Bruni in NYTimes.com, and he absolutely did. In a flawless, forceful 24-minute live address, the 77-year-old candidate not only disproved Trump's disgraceful accusations of senility, but movingly pitched himself as an optimistic, resilient public servant, uniquely qualified to, in Biden's words, overcome this season of darkness in America. It may be smart for Biden to appeal to voters' nostalgia for the recent past, said Sarah Jones in NYMag.com. Even some Republicans are pining for the relative normalcy of the pre-Trump era. Hence the convention speeches from Republican never-Trumpers John Kasich and Colin Powell. But will Biden's promise of a return to normal and to bipartisan compromise fire up the Democrats' progressive base? The young activists who represent the party's future want revolution, not a return to the status quo of unchecked climate change, wealth inequality, and racial injustice. Clearly, Democrats were worried that Trump's smears about left-wing mobs might frighten moderate voters, said Amy Davidson Sorkin in NewYorker.com. But they overcompensated and treated progressive voters almost as an afterthought. This was a four-day exercise in sleight of hand, said Matthew Continetti in the Washington Free Beacon. We heard time and again how Biden, with his undeniable decency and empathy, will heal Americans' wounds and build back better, as the title of Biden's economic plan puts it. But the speakers were awfully vague about what this would mean in practice for the blue-collar voters that Democrats are supposedly trying to recapture. The increasingly desperate working families of America want concrete plans to improve their lives, said Ronald Brownstein in TheAtlantic.com. Biden has released a detailed job creation agenda, but at the convention provided only uplifting rhetoric about brighter tomorrows. As they did in 2016, Democrats may come to regret not directing a more targeted economic appeal at the voters Trump is relying on most. Voters now have seen plenty of Trump, said Isaac Shore in NationalReview.com. He's chosen to be the president of Charlottesville and QAnon, the mean-spirited man who again last week attacked the late Republican war hero John McCain as a lousy candidate. When the only alternative is Trump, Biden's kind and reasonable affect should be more than enough to deliver him the White House. Biden may be a throwback to a backslapping era when Democrats and Republicans made deals in hideaway Senate offices, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. But civility, bipartisanship, basic decency, and public service are not mere nostalgia. These virtues are the moral architecture of democracy, and they truly will be on the ballot this November. And in our Good Week, Bad Week segment, it was a good week for stealth after a group of unknown intruders working under cover of darkness slipped like ninjas into a popular ninja museum in Iga City, Japan, cracked the safe, and made off with more than a million yen. That's about $9,470. It was a three-minute job, said an impressed ninja museum official. It was a good week for omens, with a warning from NASA that a small asteroid, 2018 VP1, may hit Earth on November 2nd, the day before the U.S. presidential election. Fortunately, the asteroid is less than 7 feet across, meaning it will likely burn up in the atmosphere. And it was a good week for watery beer, after a California man saved his workshop from the wildfires by pouring his supply of Bud Light on the flames until firefighters arrived. My buddies all tease me about drinking water beer, said Chad Little, but I say, hey, saved my shop. But it was a bad week for getting along after an Indian woman filed for divorce from her husband, citing his refusal to argue with her. Whenever I make a mistake, he always forgives me, the woman complained to a judge. I am feeling suffocated in such an environment. It was a bad week for microaggressions, with new research suggesting that people now in their teens and early 20s, Generation Z, find the use of periods in text messages by older people to be hostile. And finally, it was a bad week for machismo after Robert O'Neill, a former Navy SEAL who claims to have killed Osama bin Laden, tweeted a photo of himself maskless aboard a Delta flight above the caption, "I am not a pussy." O'Neill was banned from future Delta flights, and when his tweet disappeared, he wrote, "I didn't delete my tweet. My wife did." The title of our briefing page article is Air Travel in the Coronavirus Era. Passenger traffic has plunged 70% and airlines are losing billions. What's the future of flying? How safe is it to fly? Safer than you might think for an activity that involves strangers congregating for long stretches in a cramped metal tube. Most viruses and other germs do not spread easily on flight, said the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, citing commercial airline sophisticated air filtration and circulation systems. Airplanes typically refresh their entire air volume every few minutes. Recirculated air is pumped through high-efficiency filters that remove 99.97% of virus-sized particles. The primary risk in flying is that an infected passenger could sit next to or near you and exhale, cough, or sneeze virus-laden droplets that you'd breathe in before they were filtered out. But while evidence is limited, the data to date suggests only rare possible occurrences of in-flight transmission of COVID-19, said Lin Chen, a Harvard Medical School professor and expert in travel medicine. When 12 infected passengers flew from the U.S. to Taiwan in March, there were no confirmed infections among the other 328 people on board. However, a recent study found that two passengers were infected by other passengers sitting across the aisle from them after a four-hour flight from Tel Aviv to Frankfurt in March. On a flight from the UK to Vietnam the same month, one passenger apparently spread the virus to 14 passengers and a crew member. What safety precautions are airlines taking? Between flights, planes are routinely sprayed with a fog of electrostatic disinfectant and otherwise sanitized. Many airlines have dialed back food and drink service to cut down on interaction between passengers and crew, and board planes from back to front to reduce passenger contact. And some have limited passenger capacity to increase distancing. Delta and JetBlue keep middle seats empty, while Southwest books flights to no more than two-thirds capacity. American and United have no such limits, though both allow passengers to rebook high-volume flights without charge and attempt to alert passengers when flights are filling up. What about masks? In late April, JetBlue became the first airline to require masks. All major airlines now mandate them. In the early days, there was spotty compliance, and some airlines adopted a hands-off policy to avoid confrontations, instructing flight attendants not to challenge maskless passengers. But they've since cracked down, with American and Southwest ending medical exemptions. Maskless passengers have been removed from flights in some cases, and many have been placed on no-fly lists. That's what happened last week to Robert O'Neill, the Navy SEAL who killed Osama bin Laden after he refused to mask up on a Delta flight. Flight attendant and pilot unions have asked for a blanket federal rule requiring masks on flights. We need the backing of the government and clear consequences for those who don't comply, said Sarah Nelson, president of the Association of Flight Attendants. But the airlines have opposed a federal mask mandate, saying their own rules are adequate and they don't want the industry to be singled out. How big a hit has the industry taken? A huge one. In April, passenger traffic cratered to around 4% of the usual number. Since then, it's revived somewhat, but it's still running about 70% below pre-pandemic levels. The financial fallout has been massive. The four largest U.S. airlines lost a combined $10 billion from April through June. This year, U.S. carriers are expected to lose $84 billion, which would make it the worst year in aviation history. And with steep infection rates across much of the U.S. and surveys showing many Americans are wary of flying, there's no recovery in sight. U.S. airlines received a $25 billion bailout through the CARES Act. As part of the deal, they can't lay off staff until October 1st. They've scaled back the workforce through buyouts and early retirements, but have given notice that without another bailout, mass layoffs are in store this fall. United said it could furlough 36,000 employees, nearly half its U.S. workforce. American says 25,000 of its workers may face layoffs. What's the long-term outlook? Nobody expects a quick turnaround. After 9/11, ridership was depressed for years, and airlines didn't become profitable again until 2007. Industry officials do not anticipate a full recovery until 2024, and some believe passenger volume may never return to pre-pandemic heights. It's going to be a slower and more uneven recovery than one might have expected, said Standard & Poor's analyst Philip Bagley. Business travel, which has provided airlines with a large percentage of their profits, may never fully bounce back now that video conferencing has become standard. What the industry will look like by the time the pandemic is over is very unclear. Some major airlines could go under, and some analysts predict mergers and takeovers. Airlines are going to fall by the wayside, said industry analyst John Strickland. I feel sadly sure that aviation is going to be much smaller. We'll read a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. The first, don't make a vaccine mandatory. The surest way to create fear and resistance to a coronavirus vaccine, said Jim Garrity, is to make getting it mandatory. That's what Virginia Commissioner of Health Dr. Norman Oliver said last week he plans to do if and when a vaccine becomes available, under state law that can be invoked in a public health crisis. I personally believe the Food and Drug Administration and other authorities will not approve a vaccine before it is carefully tested for effectiveness and possible side effects. Still, it's not surprising that people would be at least a little wary about a new vaccine that will be the fastest developed one in human history. These skeptics will not be reassured if they're told that a giant pharmaceutical company says it's safe, and government bureaucrats demand they line up for a shot. It would be far wiser and more effective to engage in a campaign of public persuasion and let those eager to be vaccinated go first. Their experience and testimonials will be powerful endorsements during the many months in which the country is producing enough vaccine doses to immunize anyone who wants one. So why coerce people? We've got enough public paranoia out there already. Why I prefer to vote in person. I don't fault anyone who chooses to submit a ballot through the post office, said Jeff Jacoby. But this election day, I'm casting mine in person. First of all, I don't want to risk my ballot being lost or rejected. In every election, mailed ballots are more likely not to be counted, either because of problems with the mail itself or because election officials disqualify them on the grounds that signatures don't match or some other detail is wrong. With tens of millions of additional votes coming via mail this November, I don't want my vote to be among those disqualified. Fear of the coronavirus won't keep me from the polls, which have plexiglass shields installed between voters and poll workers and spaced out voting machines. With hand sanitizer and masks, voting is relatively safe. I also am still moved by the communitarian spirit of voting together on election day. Seeing your neighbors at the polls, all of us equal in casting one vote, is a stirring reinforcement of democracy itself. As usual, I'm not happy with the choices on the ballot, but I'm going to vote in person this year and hope, as ever, for the best. Here's an interesting one from India. Coding instead of crayoning. My son is 4 years old, said G. Sampath, but apparently he is already falling behind in the highly competitive world of Indian overachievers. A friend of mine told me this week about BlueShift, a site that offers online coding classes for kids ages 4 to 15. I have now learned what every Indian parent other than me already seemed to know. A child old enough to walk is old enough to code. We all want our kids to become the next Sundar Pichai, the American Indian American CEO of Google, don't we? Well, the best way to boost them along that road is to ensure that, in addition to being fluent in English and Hindi, they also master a motherboard tongue or two. I guess the ultimate goal is to get kids to launch their own apps and become billionaires by age 10. At that point, with financial security for the whole family set, maybe a kid could enjoy a normal childhood and learn at his own pace without worrying about exams, grades, college admissions, or job prospects. Until then, though, we are all supposed to drive our youngsters just as hard as we can and make sure they don't waste any computer time on crayons or blocks. If anyone knows of a startup accelerator program for nursery kindrepreneurs, do drop me a mail. We're on to the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, The Making of Stephen Miller. Family financial setbacks led to Miller attending a diverse California high school with many poor immigrants, said journalist Gene Guerrero. His resentments later came to shape national policy. Stephen Miller started at Santa Monica High School in 1999. His high school years came amid a period of family turmoil. Miller's father, Michael, was having financial troubles and fighting several legal battles related to his real estate company, including a fight with his brother, whom he later permanently separated from the family with a no-contact order and a settlement agreement. The family had moved out of a million-dollar home in a wealthy white neighborhood to a slightly smaller house in a more diverse neighborhood. Michael Miller would refinance the house three times in the next 4 years. Rather than attending a private school the way Michael's youngest son later did, his oldest son, Stephen, found himself at a diverse public school, which celebrated Dia de los Muertos and Cinco de Mayo. The year before Miller started high school, Santa Monica had experienced 8 gang-related shootings within a couple of weeks, resulting in 5 deaths, including one across from the high school. The high school was experiencing what administrators called a two-schools phenomenon. One part went on to Ivy League and top universities. The other part dropped out. In high school, Miller discovered conservative talk radio, The Larry Elder Show. In the 1990s, Elder was a rising star, broadcast in the afternoon on KABC 790 across Los Angeles. A Los Angeles Times article described Elder as a darling of white listeners who seemed to almost gush when they telephoned him on KABC talk radio, astonished to find a black man who wasn't going to chastise them. In 2001, Elder published the book, The 10 Things You Can't Say in America. In it, he argues that black people are more racist than white people, and that the problems of black people came from a lack of self-determination. Elder wrote, "At American dinner tables all across the country, most parents urge their children to work hard, study hard, and prepare. But in black households, how much dinner table talk revolves around the white man done me wrong rather than focuses on grit, hard work, and preparation." Like Rush Limbaugh, another formative influence on Miller, Elder dedicated a chapter to media bias and belittled the idea of sexism, saying, Smart women simply overlook boorish behavior by men. Miller called into his new show and invited him to speak at his high school. Elder agreed. He came to campus and stood in front of a diverse crowd of Santa Monica High School students, including Miller. He told them they had to learn how to pull themselves up by the bootstraps and not use race as social capital. Maria Vivanco, a classmate who was president of the school's Chicano activist organization, MECHA, recalls that Miller seemed aroused by Elder's speech. Vivanco watched the pleasure in his face and felt herself getting really angry. She stood up and confronted her classmate. "You're a racist," she said. Miller shouted back, telling her she was wrong and didn't understand. In retrospect, she says, "I think, looking back, he didn't like being confronted by a Latina girl, a teenage girl." In his junior year at Santa Monica High School, Stephen Miller ran for student announcer. His father had gotten elected student body president at another high school 35 years earlier with a memorably subversive speech that turned him into a school hero. Like Michael Miller, Stephen would also give a speech that people would remember for years. He sauntered on stage before a large, noisy crowd. "Hi, I'm Stephen Miller," he said. He gripped the microphone and squinted his face with practiced confidence. "He was the only candidate," he said, "who really stands out. I will say and I will do things that no one else in their right mind would do or say." He continued with his face reddening with emotion, his voice rising to a shout. "Am I the only one who is sick and tired of being told to pick up my trash when we have plenty of janitors who are paid to do it for us?" The school had thousands of students and about 10 custodians, mostly people of color. Students erupted in a roar of disapproval. Student Assembly President Colleen Armstrong Yamamura was worried that students were about to riot. "I just remember the crowd at that point going kind of nuts. We had very volatile racial relations," she says. She thought Miller's comments were classist and racist. "I can't remember if somebody threw things at him, but I felt it was on the brink of getting there," she says. She told him his time was up. "You need to get down," she says. He kept talking, relishing the moment. "So I took him physically, and I pushed him off the stage." When he got to Duke University 2 years later, there were signs that Miller would pick up right where he left off in high school. Freshman year, he lived on the second floor of Pegram Dormitory. The dorm was on East Campus, with red brick Jeffersonian architecture along a verdant quad. During orientation, a second floor resident advisor asked his group of male residents to gather outside. Seated on the grass, the counselor asked them to introduce themselves, name, hometown, something about themselves. Most remained seated, but Miller sprang to his feet. "Hi, I'm Stephen Miller," he said, just as he'd started his high school speech. "I'm from Santa Monica, California, and I like guns." His spectators chuckled, unsure if he was joking. He sat down. The introductions continued, but Miller had made an impression. He had a nickname now, Guns. His dorm mates called him Stephen Guns Miller. The dorm residents gathered in the first floor common room for pizza, salad, and refreshments. They were getting to know one another during this first chapter away from home. When Miller threw his plate away, he missed the trash can and leftovers spilled on the floor. He walked away. A classmate asked, "Are you not going to pick that up?" Miller replied, "What hellhole are you from? We have people here for that." Another recalls having lunch with him in the cafeteria. Every now and then, Miller would leave his tray on the table, saying it wasn't his responsibility to clean it up. One classmate recalls that he tossed his tray on the ground, saying, "There were people there paid to clean it up." A few weeks into freshman year, a graduate assistant in charge of Pegram Dorm put a temporary lockdown on the common room because students were leaving it so messy. The dorm manager taped up a piece of paper letting students know that the custodial staff was not there to enable their filthy lifestyles. It encouraged them to pick up after themselves like grown-ups. Miller taped a typed 2-page reply protesting the punishment. Classmate Sean Hu says it described cleanliness as a fine personal virtue, but ultimately it's the responsibility of the janitorial staff to ensure that it's clean. And it's too bad that $40,000 a year doesn't make sure that people understand that. On June 16, 2015, Trump rode down the golden escalator at Trump Tower, his yellow eyebrows and hair glimmering in his gilded atrium. He pursed his lips at the podium. "Whoa," he said, glancing at the crowd. "That is some group of people. Thousands." He was running for the Republican presidential nomination. Like Miller, Trump was an outsider to the Republican establishment. He said politically incorrect things. "When do we beat Mexico at the border? They're laughing at us, at our stupidity, and now they're beating us economically. They are not our friend." Then, when Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with them. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crimes. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. He evoked the image of a soiled America, a dumping ground. People had belittled Miller all his life for his views, deriding him as he stood on stage demanding that custodians of color pick up his trash. They called him racist. They called him classist. They questioned him. Here was a powerful magnate beaming Miller's own thoughts into American homes across the nation. Miller felt a jolt of electricity. He told the Washington Post it was as though everything that I felt at the deepest levels of my heart were now being expressed by a candidate for our nation's highest office before a watching world. Trump's comments were widely perceived as racist, but he refused to apologize, telling CNN's Don Lemon, "Someone's doing the raping." Steve Bannon, Miller's mentor and chief of the increasingly influential Breitbart News, was cringing a little. Trump's campaign had potential, but he needed help. Trump was focused mostly on his wealth. He had singled out the issues that Bannon, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions, and Miller had talked about during their lengthy dinner the previous year as they plotted a populist national insurgency: trade and immigration. But Trump didn't present solid policy solutions. He promised a border wall that Mexico would pay for. But the wall had been conceived by consultants Sam Nunberg and Roger Stone to get Trump to remember to talk about immigration. It was a mnemonic device, not a policy proposal. Experts knew transnational cartels were digging tunnels 90 feet underground in San Diego, the most fortified border area, with layered steel fencing, and that nearly half of all people in the country illegally were visa overstays who entered through airports and ports of entry. Bannon reached out to the campaign and said he knew of a guy who could help. He could pull double duty, speechwriter and policy writer for Trump, 2-for-1. Sessions gave Miller a glowing recommendation, comparing him to George W. Bush's political mastermind, Karl Rove. But the campaign wasn't convinced. Campaign manager Corey Lewandowski dragged his feet on hiring Miller. Miller started reaching out to Lewandowski directly, bombarding him with emails at 2 o'clock in the morning. "We have to talk immigration. We have to talk immigration," Miller told him. "Let me come to the campaign," he said. "Let me help draft your immigration policy." Miller put together an immigration plan for Trump, with references to murders, rapes, and beatings by people who lived in the United States without legal permission. The plan highlighted Miller's passion for the macabre. An illegal immigrant from Mexico with a long arrest record is charged with breaking into a 64-year-old woman's home, crushing her skull and eye sockets with a hammer, raping her, and murdering her, the immigration plan read. It drew a contrast between Trump and wealthy globe-trotting donors. In Miller's view, the rich, excluding Trump, had a nefarious plot to pollute the U.S., as did Mexico. He took the seed Trump had introduced and adorned it. Mexico's leaders have been taking advantage of the United States by using illegal immigration to export the crime and poverty in their own country. U.S. taxpayers have been asked to pick up hundreds of billions in health care costs, housing costs, education costs, welfare costs, etc. The plan laid out steps to make America great again, in addition to the wall, tripling ICE officers, implementing nationwide E-Verify, mass deportations, an end to catch and release, defunding sanctuary cities, enhanced penalties for visa overstays, an end to birthright citizenship, a requirement to hire American workers, and ending welfare abuse. In January, the campaign announced it had hired Miller as a senior policy advisor. Ann Coulter, who in one article had compared migrants to cockroaches, tweeted, "I'm in heaven. Trump hires Senator Sessions' brain trust. He's not backing down on immigration." Miller finally got to work for his idol. Surely, neither man knew how momentous it was. This was adapted from the book Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda by Gene Guerrero. We'll pick up a couple of the health and science pieces this week, starting with groundbreaking saliva test approved. The Food and Drug Administration has given emergency approval to a new saliva-based COVID-19 test, potentially providing the country with a fast and cheap way to diagnose the disease. Unlike existing tests, Saliva Direct doesn't require nasal swabs or specialized chemical reagents that have become scarce in the pandemic. Instead, those taking the $10 saliva test developed by researchers at Yale University simply spit into a sterile container. Saliva Direct can produce results in under 3 hours with accuracy on par with nasal swabbing, reports CNN.com, and should be on the market in the coming weeks. Spit samples still need to be analyzed at a laboratory, but because Saliva Direct does not require any proprietary equipment, a wide variety of labs should be able to scale up the testing method quickly. Providing this type of flexibility for processing saliva samples to test for COVID-19 infection is groundbreaking, said FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn. Saliva Direct could help overwhelmed labs meet the surging demand for tests. Many Americans are still having to wait days or even weeks to get their results. And the longer an infected person has to wait to be diagnosed, the more likely he or she is to spread the disease to other people. If cheap alternatives like Saliva Direct can be implemented across the country, we may finally get a handle on this pandemic, even before a vaccine. And another short piece about COVID, close to herd immunity. A growing number of scientists suspect that herd immunity for the coronavirus, when enough people have been infected or vaccinated that the virus can no longer spread widely, may be closer than previously thought. Early in the pandemic, epidemiologists estimated that the threshold was 70% of a given population. But more than a dozen scientists told the New York Times that statistical modeling suggests that herd immunity might occur at 50%. Or possibly even lower. Some say that particularly hard-hit neighborhoods may already be there. I'm quite prepared to believe that there are pockets in New York City and London that have substantial immunity, said Harvard epidemiologist Bill Hannage. But other epidemiologists warn that focusing on herd immunity is a distraction and could encourage people to abandon measures proven to reduce spread, such as mask wearing. Antibody testing has shown that no city or country is yet close to a 50% previous infection rate. Only 10% of the global population has COVID-19 antibodies. We'd be playing with fire if we pretended we're done with this, said Jeffrey Shaman, an epidemiologist at Columbia University. And we'll turn on over to the Talking Points page. Here's an article, Wildfires, California's Hellish New Reality. The future of climate change looks like California, said David Calloway in USA Today. An apocalyptic combination of brutal heat and nearly 12,000 lightning strikes, many in dry thunderstorms without rain, ignited more than 600 wildfires last week, including the second and third worst in state history. They've torched 1.2 million acres, an area larger than Rhode Island, threatening precious Northern California forests, and Napa and Sonoma's wine country, while forcing more than 170,000 residents to evacuate. Seven people have died, and millions of people breathing smoky air could be more vulnerable to respiratory infections such as COVID-19. To add to the chaos, temperatures soared above 100 degrees, and energy regulators imposed rolling blackouts as demand for air conditioning overtaxed the grid. This is what the coming climate disaster will bring: fire, droughts, floods, and hurricanes, finger pointing, mass evacuations, and millions of angry people. The pandemic has made this disaster even worse, said Rebecca Onion in Slate.com. Shelters for evacuees are notoriously bad places for infectious diseases. Hundreds of Californians contracted norovirus in evacuation centers during 2018's Camp Fire. It's been a logistical nightmare to set up sanitized, socially distanced shelters while also providing virus protection for 14,000 firefighters, plus the inmate crews California depends on. And because the state released many inmates during coronavirus outbreaks in prisons this spring, just 90 of the 192 inmate fire teams are currently available. Wildfires and pandemics have much in common, said Stephen Pine in the Los Angeles Times. Both are caused by a combination of natural forces and human failure to respond strategically. Californians must relearn how to coexist with wildfires because they're never going away. California is Australia now, said David Wallace Wells in NYMag.com. Last year, the land down under suffered what's now known as Black Summer, when bushfires burned 72,000 square miles, killing billions of animals and flooding Sydney with air so thick with smoke, ferries couldn't navigate its harbor. California's fires this week aren't quite as grim, but they could be next time. The state's perennial hellscape should provide a warning about our new climate reality. As rampaging wildfires, extreme weather, and punishing storms become more and more common in the years to come, scenes of unfolding terror will haunt Americans and all of humanity. And a few shorter notes in the time we've got left. One in five working-age adults is jobless because the pandemic disrupted their child care, according to research from the Census Bureau and the Federal Reserve. Women are nearly three times as likely as men to have left jobs to tend to children not attending school or daycare. Sales of existing homes jumped 25% in July, making the biggest monthly gain ever. Industry experts attribute the boost to the pandemic, with many Americans seeking more spacious homes, fleeing cities, or moving closer to family. The U.S. abortion rate is lower than it was in 1973, when the U.S. Supreme Court legalized abortion in every state. There were 13.5 abortions per 1,000 women ages 15 to 44 in 2017, the last year for which statistics are available, compared with 16.3 in 1973 and 29.3 in 1982, when abortions peaked. On the poll watch, Joe Biden is far less disliked by independent voters than Hillary Clinton was in 2016. 31 see Biden unfavorably, compared with 51% who viewed Clinton unfavorably. Biden leads President Trump among likely voters, 51% to 43%. 88% of Democrats and 60% of Republicans say the Postal Service should receive more funding to ensure timely delivery. And we've got a couple of tongue-in-cheek quotes for you. Mae West says, "I generally avoid temptation unless I can't resist it." While George Burns adds, "Love is a lot like a backache. It doesn't show on x-rays, but you know it's there." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.